You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 5th of July 2019. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live at RadioAryan.com tonight because we have with us the producer of the great Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, communism by the back door, and the Freemasonic victory of World War II, and that's the first time that I ever messed that up. Mr. Dennis Here. Wise, yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks. Yeah, all right. Busy, but I'm all right.
Is it hot enough for you?
Too hot.
Roasting sunshine.
Yeah, well, there's no air ventilation in a bunker.
Certainly isn't when we're doing these podcasts either, is there? No fans, no aircon. It's beautiful weather, though. Absolutely beautiful weather. Finally, the summer is here in Britain since Midsummer's Day as well. It's been
There was a time when I could stop out all night in a nightclub, go boozing, come home, say 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be up at 6 o'clock in the morning and go play tennis.
How long ago was that, Dennis?
It wasn't that long ago, well, maybe.
I used to have the old late nights and be up very early in the morning. I had a job that I had to be up at sort of 3, 4, or 5 o'clock in the morning at one time. I used to get a little kip in the afternoon, heavy drinking. I couldn't do that now.
Well, as you discovered this week, I still stop up late. I just don't
you do.
To the nightclubs.
You do. I had a real shock there, Dennis. Trying to contact you at 8:30 in the morning to ask you about a possible debate that might be taking place in the future that listeners will be interested to hear about when it does. And I thought, this is surprising. You're up here at 8:30. Yeah. No. You told me you've been up all night. All night and still there. Just about to go to bed at 8:30. Well, there you go. Well, all I can say is you must have been hard at work on the next episode of the Freemasonic Victory, I would guess. Would I be right?
Well, that was part of it, but there was other things as well. I discovered one or two other things. And when I get in the floor, I hate to break, because if I break off, sometimes I don't get it back, so I stick with it. And if it means working into the early morning daylight, then so be it. It's been done many times.
Yeah, some people are like that. I used to know somebody else used to do his best work at 2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, he was a real night owl, and other people, you know, I know somebody else that gets up sort of 5 o'clock in the morning and gets everything done, and you know, he's off to bed about 7 or 8 o'clock at night. You know, everybody has different sort of circadian rhythms, I guess. Yeah. Well, we're all looking forward to the next episode when it comes out anyway. And we've got, if you can manage to get it uploaded. Have you had any more help with BitChute?
I forgot to tell you.
Go on.
That part what I put up about 3 weeks ago, it's finally got up.
Hey, fantastic. So it's just taken a while.
A couple of weeks.
Yeah. Just taken a while to render, I guess, or finalise itself. Well, that's good news anyway. So there's another episode up there for people to watch.
13 up there, yes. I've only got another 8 to go, I think.
Good stuff. Well, we've got four particular subjects to talk about tonight, and three of them were sent in by one of our listeners, Mr. Simple, and he writes in every so often. He sends me an email. Very polite chap. Likes to ask questions about what we're talking about. And I thought these three questions that he's brought up this week, they would do quite well for an episode, because they're all talking about historical National Socialist things that we cover here on this podcast. And on the first question from him, he says, a podcast or two ago, you and Mr. Wise discussed the German concentration camps during World War II. During your discussion, it was mentioned the camps had knocking shops. I can't help but notice knocking shops as being a thwart to the ideology and morality of the National Socialists. Could you help me understand the National Socialists' justification, please? And I think, this is quite a large subject. I mean, they didn't just have them in the camps, apparently. They had them in all the occupied territories. And the reason for this is because you've got soldiers there. And you've also got people that are fighting alongside these soldiers. They could be dying tomorrow. A lot of them, you know, just wanted to have sex in case they died tomorrow. And also you've got, people with drives that needed fulfilling and they didn't want, you know, rapes occurring or anything like that. Also, they wanted to make certain that prostitutes were clean. These prostitutes that were there, they were regularly checked, and they were actually provided by the medical department, by the Office of Medicine or whatever it was that was responsible for that. They were the ones that actually provided them, and they were checked racially to ensure that they were Aryan, I guess. These ones that were in the camps, maybe they checked them to see that they were Jews, if the Jews were making use of them. So that was really the justification for it, was necessity, because of course they didn't want prostitution. The reason they didn't want prostitution is because it spread syphilis. That was the main reason for it. So they were checking these prostitutes to make sure that they didn't catch these diseases. They ended up eradicating syphilis, and it meant that it was centered in one place, whereas before, during Weimar, it was like everywhere. It was all on the streets. So I think that played a large, you know, that was the largest part of it, just accepting that, they, you know, it's the oldest profession. We can't really get rid of it. What we've really got to do is make it as safe as possible, limit it to certain places where the public aren't going to see it, and make certain that, you know, the Hitler Youth aren't going to be able to go in there. Obviously, they weren't allowed in there. You know, you could make certain of the ages of the people that were allowed in there. What are your thoughts on this, Dennis?
Well, you more or less covered everything, but you just missed one particular reason as well, which I discovered. And that was Himmler made it a ritual at least once a week for the Pink Brigade, as they call them, the homosexual prisoners, to visit a brothel, you know, thinking that, you know, they'll get to like what they're doing and change their ways.
Well, that's really good, isn't it? As a part of the re-education, that shows that, you know, they were trying to reform these prisoners. They were trying to make them so that they could go back out into society and be productive members of society. You know, that's why it said work will set you free.
The worst way is to get reformed.
Yeah, well, obviously that's what they were doing with these homosexuals. You know, that treatment for the homosexuals.
No, it doesn't
kill them, but it works. That's why they banned it.
Yeah.
There's no way they would have banned it if it didn't work, because they would have used and said, look, this doesn't work.
The propaganda said that, you know, gays were lives were at risk. Well, that's a funny way of risking a gay's life, sending him to a brothel.
So there were reasons why they had these. Obviously, it goes against the morality. If you want people to stay married, you don't want them to get divorced. But they had all these incentives for that. You know, for each child you had, you would get part of the mortgage paid. And there is actually a criticism that later on during the war, there were a lot of children that were being born out of wedlock, because it was seen as more important to actually produce more Aryan children than anything else. So that is a criticism that the number of children that were born with only one parent or whatever on the registry certificate, that did go up, but the whole amount of children that were being born went up massively, which is what they wanted to do. They wanted to increase the number of Germans, so they had incentives for that, and they had incentives for people to stay together, and they didn't want them being born from prostitution, obviously. So that's what, again, a reason for having these brothels legalized and checking on the girls,
unfortunately,
and looking after them.
I read somewhere, unfortunately, when the Russians invaded and raped the women, between 1945 and 1946, the babies were born 4% were from Russian fathers.
And there's a lot of propaganda about saying that the Germans were, you know, sort of doing the same thing to the Russian girls, but.
Yeah.
From what I read, nowhere near as bad as the accusations of what the Red Army did.
Hanging offence. I mean, the Russian brats, they encouraged it. In fact, demanded it. whereas Germans, it was a hanging offence.
Well, there was a quote on one of these anti-German sites, and it was talking about the Germans in one of these Russian areas, and apparently there was a 30-year-old woman there, and this German sort of referred to her as a brass and said, well, you know, what are you doing flogging your wares on the street? And she said, well, we need bread. And the younger one that was with her, this guy's writing, said that she was about 15, and this German sort of groped her and said, she's okay, we can use her. Now, that might sound a bit shocking, but it's really not that bad compared to the Red Army.
Getting nailed to a barn door.
That's not these girls being forced, is it? And having horrific things done to them. That's, women offering what they've got in exchange for rations. Which is not rape.
Which is what the Germans did with the Americans at the end of the war.
What the Germans did with the Americans?
Yeah, because they were starving.
Yeah, well, and they did offer their wares. I mean, that just sort of happens during the war, doesn't it? And in the Nuremberg Tribunal, apparently there was a thing about these brothels and forcing women to work in brothels. But that was at the Nuremberg Tribunal, and we can't place any trust in what was said there
at all,
because it was all from torture. I mean, this is what's so bad about this, because they got these confessions through torture. You cannot accept anything that came out of that. It's got no credibility. So that really doesn't help matters.
That's it. I mean, even now at that time, it wasn't released that the Russians raped 2 million women, but they had a Russian judge there who was passing judgment over German officers and soldiers. It's kangaroo court in anybody's eyes.
And in the camps, they said that they forced these women that had gone in the camps to work in the brothels. But if they were trying to gas them all, what was the point in having them working in brothels? And who were these brothels for if they were gassing people? And there's also this idea that in the camps they put Jews in the brothels, but why would the SS officers want to have sex with a Jew? Yeah, and
there's another angle.
Go on.
There's another angle. I read again. Somebody wrote that the women, the Jewish women at Auschwitz, were in most danger during the Holocaust, inverted commas. Well, that's not strictly true, because I've seen a Jewish woman who was, her and her daughter, which was freed by the Russians, and the Russians went on a rampage for the next few weeks and raped anybody they could, including prisoners from Auschwitz. And she even said, at least we didn't get raped by the Germans. So another fabrication.
And also, if they're going to have special checks on the race of the prostitutes in the brothels to make certain that they are Aryan, why would they not be doing the same in these prisons? I should imagine that any SS officer caught having sex with a Jewish prostitute would lose his job and his rank and his position and have a public shaming for doing that and betraying his race in such a way. So there were reasons for them to have these brothels, and I'm sort of stuck up really in two minds on the subject today on what would be the right way to deal with it, whether you would want to just sort of have a legalized area for it where it could be checked, or whether you should really be punishing these people. It's because people would always look out for
the oldest occupation.
Yeah,
never gonna stop it.
I think what we need to do is concentrate on encouraging people to get married and stay together. That's the important thing. For the sake of the children.
That's the direction we're going today, isn't it? Marriages every year.
If the whole point of the husband and the wife getting married is that they're giving their consent, basically, and the woman is giving her consent to have sex whenever the man wants it. That's part of the old wedding vow. That's what it meant. And the other way around as well, obviously. The man is supposed to give sex to the woman whenever she wants it. And if you had that, then there would be no excuse for anybody to want to go and see a prostitute. If every man had a wife that satisfied them.
Interestingly enough, I saw a few minutes of a debate with Piers Morgan, and he was having a go at this guy for saying that what have you got against same-sex marriage? And this guy was trying to explain to Piers Morgan that marriage was about a man and a woman, two totally different, you know, species, who, when joined together, become as one with the children. And it just wouldn't go through Pierce's head. It really wouldn't. So it's another angle.
Oh, it's where they've separated the sexual act from the production of children, and they just think it's about hedonism. They've, you know, it seems to have escaped their mind that it's, you know, it's a key that fits into a keyhole that opens the door to Correct. Having children. You know, you can't put Correct. Two keys together. You know, you like E. Michael Jones says, these homosexuals, they obviously don't understand the concept of a jigsaw puzzle. You know, you look for the pieces that fit together. Yep. Not the ones that don't.
I'll mention that to Elton next time I see him.
Well, the next question that we've got from Mr. Simple here, he says, as you mentioned in the podcast, Hitler's plan was to relocate the Jewish population to either Madagascar or a region of Russia. If I recall from my reading of Mein Kampf, Hitler described Jews as being alien to Europe insofar as they are racially different. Furthermore, you commented as Jews having a distinct phenotype characteristic of the East. Within the alt-right, Jews are also considered non-white. If Jews are seen as not being European, then why would Hitler want to relocate them to a region of Russia? Now, he's got a good point here. If you think, you know, well, that's not very nice, is it? Well, you know, offloading all these Jews on Russians, and, you know, maybe you could say, well, you know, they're at war with Russia or whatever, so they want to offload them on these white Russians. But that's when you're not thinking about the actual part of Russia that it was intended to do that. And they've got an autonomous zone in Russia called Byro-Bijan, which was the Jewish autonomy zone. That was their own effective state that they had in the USSR, and that was set up at a very early period, I think probably about before in the 1930s, I think, Byro-Bijan was set up. And it's actually right on the furthermost east part of the USSR. And in actual fact, it's now about 90% Chinese. And Russia is saying, we want people to move to Byro-Bijan because otherwise we're going to lose this country to all these Chinese that are just crossing over the border and setting up there and breeding, because it's right on the far eastern part of the USSR on the border with Mongolia. So
thought that was the safest place to put them.
Yeah, well,
it's the harm's way.
Furthest away from Europe, but it's also in a part of Russia that is not white anyway. So it wouldn't have mattered. But otherwise, that's quite a good point, I think.
Well, Jews don't class themselves as white. Well, they do when it suits them. But you know, nine times out of ten, they look at white as not good.
Yeah, they'll quite often say that amongst themselves, won't they? Don't forget, never forget, we are not white. We're part of the ethnic minorities, and that's why they stand up for them. But then when you're looking at quotas of how many people there are in the BBC or in the banks or whatever, they'll just say, look, it's 90% white. They won't say, well, actually, it's 70% Jewish and 20% Correct. White. So it all depends on...
The white slave traders.
Yeah, white slave trade. Yeah. It all depends on what side their bread is butted, really. But yeah, they're not white. I mean, obviously they've been in Europe for a long time, and where they've interbred with the locals, their skin has sort of lightened in colour. But really, they're the same people as their enemies, the Palestinians.
Well, to be honest, when you watch them growing old, actors in Hollywood, the more Jewish they go, you know, from what we're possibly not really Jewish looking at a young age, but the older they go, they just turn into old Jews. And it's, you know, physically, you can see it.
I do think that Happy Merchant meme is very clever. I mean, it's got, if you look at that, it's just got every bit there is that you can use to tell a Jew, that the forehead, the ears, the nose, the lips. You know, whenever you see a Jew, there will always be one part of them that looks like a part of that Happy Merchant meme. This is one thing that the National Socialists were very good at, was their depictions of Jews. and alerting people to these subtle differences. And when you don't actually have other non-whites among you, when you don't have blacks and Chinese and Arabs and all the rest of them among you, then the Jews do stand out a lot more, which is why they like to encourage immigration so much, because then they don't stand out so much and they look a little bit closer to being white than all these other peoples do. I mean, if you've got a European country and it's got loads of Congolese Negroes in it and it's got some Jews, I mean, the Europeans are going to feel safer among the Jews, aren't they? Just naturally, because they look a little bit closer to them than Congolese. Yeah.
So that's from the fact that the Jews want to bring immigration in for the more obvious reasons.
Oh, they like to replace us. It's the same thing that's happened in every white empire. And it's usually been the same people. I mean, you can see that it's the same people. I mean, you just look at the sandals. Tutankhamun, he's got these sandals that they found, mm-hmm. and on the soles of the sandals, it's got a Negro on one of them and a Jew on the other. So they were obviously seen as the enemy of the state, because he's walking on, you know, they're on the sole of his foot. So yeah. he's in effect walking on them whenever he walks anywhere. And it was shortly after the death of Tutankhamun that Egypt had just became overrun with these Nubians and these other races. So you can see that the Jews were in there at the time, just before that happened.
I'm convinced there's other white races, like you say, or empires, have been wiped out by the same way they're trying to do it to us now. They get to a certain position where they can control the money for one, and things then move on from then. They can control the governments, and by controlling the governments, control the foreign policy, and also control the immigration. It becomes easy when you're controlling the press as well. The press and the money, two main things.
Very important there. Obviously, that's how they did it in the past, and that's how they did it today. One other interesting thing about this Biro Bijam place, I think they discovered that there's actually got gold in it, and that was the reason why they wanted that particular area, because they thought that it had gold in it. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson did the research on that one and broke that story.
An invasion.
Yeah. Yeah, but as I say,
Russia, much gold left in world, so Bank of England.
Russia is actually saying that anybody that wants to move there, they'll give them, or any Russian that wants to move there, they'll give them acres of land and farming subsidies, because they want that country back, and it's been taken over by these Mongolians. But when the Jews say, well, we have to have the state in Palestine, because of all these pogroms that have happened in the past, and we have to have someone to flee to. Well, they already had this country in Biro Bijan, which wasn't moving anybody else out of there, and it wouldn't have harmed anybody else for them to have it. But I guess it was so far to the east, it wasn't central to them, like the state that they wanted in Palestine, and also it wouldn't have helped them with the scam that they are the children of Israel. Because I think that plays into it, doesn't it?
Rapid places like London anyway.
Yeah, well, they certainly haven't moved out from the Gentile nations to all move to Israel, have they? They're still in the diaspora. It's like Hitler said, it's just become a bolt hole for crooks, because they've got no extradition treaties with any other countries. They won't actually send any Jews that have committed crimes. They won't send them to the country where they committed the crimes in to go on trial. And I don't blame them for that. I don't think I think all countries should actually look after their people. Should look after their members of the nation.
Really, because they stick to them rules, but it's one rule for them and another rule for everybody else.
Yeah, that is.
I mean, I remember Bishop Williamson almost got sent to Germany when he had his problems with his TV interview.
I think he did. Did he get sent to Germany? I know he got tried in Germany, didn't he?
He didn't actually get. He didn't land in the country. I think Lady Rousseff, is it? She kind of
Lady Michelle Renouf.
A couple of, got a couple of good lawyers and. security is safety here. But yeah, you know, I'm sure there's other countries around the world have suffered by the government sending them back. And really, you know, they should do as Israel do.
That's the right thing to do, isn't it? Is to look after your people and not just hand them over to some other country. Russia won't do it. Russia won't hand over the Russians for anything that they wanted for crimes for. No, Americans won't either. But we do. The British do. I mean, we've sent quite a few people over that I remember a while back, it was some autistic lad or something, and he had managed to hack into the FBI looking for evidence of UFOs. Yeah, and he was just handed over to America where he was, you know, going to do serious time.
Like Bishop Williamson, I think they stopped the extradition, I think, by some kind of means. I don't think he actually went there for the trial.
I mean, fair enough, that you could show the evidence to the other country, or they could show the evidence to us and say, well, you know, you should be trying this guy in your own country to see if he's guilty or whatever.
I think Assange has a problem.
Sorry?
I think Assange has a problem.
Assange, yeah. Well, he's going to have problems trying to get out of Syria, isn't he? If he ever tries to get out of Syria, they'll jump on him.
And, no, that's sad.
Take him to the court. Assange. Yeah.
Yeah, the one who were in the embassy.
Yeah, definitely.
Which was a joke, by the way. Storming that embassy. It's still wrong.
He's not very well, is he? They've said that he's not well enough to stand trial.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, that broke all the laws. Broke all the asylum laws. Well, we've got a third question here. Hello, Mr. Longshanks. In a podcast not yours, Strasser was discussed. I heard somewhere the Strassers were rejects of the National Socialists. Moreover, one of them was killed in an event called Night of the Long Knives, and the other was exiled to Canada. What brought about the Strassers' ouster, and why was one of them murdered? And this is a really interesting subject that I really should know more about, I guess, because Strasserism is a form of National Socialism that, you know, some people very much get into. Matthew Heinbach gets accused of being a Strasserite. Troy Southgate from Britain, another famous nationalist, he was a Strasserite. Apparently the National Front at one time were following these Strasser ideas, and they were basically the extreme left, the far left of the National Socialists. And I've got some information here on them, on the particular Strassers, Gregor and Otto Strasser, they were called. The Strasserites advocated the radicalization of the National Socialist regime and the toppling of the German elites, calling Hitler's rise to power a half-revolution which needed to be completed. Well, we can see from that National Socialism was about the classes working together. It wasn't about class war. It wasn't about class conflict. It was about class cooperation. You know, the reason why we have these elites is because they are top people at what they're doing. That's what an elite is. It means they are the very, very best. So why would you want to get rid of all the very best people? I mean, this is the logic of envy and jealousy. So I can see why this, you know, why this didn't succeed with National Socialism, because that, I think that hits at the very root of it, is that National Socialism was about doing what's best for your race and, you know, all the classes working together, not, you know, getting rid of the upper class and taking everything. I mean, what do you think about that idea, Dennis, toppling of the German elites?
Well, from what you just told me, it doesn't sound like it's National Socialist anyway. I mean, the far left of National Socialist, you're rubbing shoulders with communists.
Well, that's exactly it. That is exactly it. Because their faction advocated support for strikes, nationalization of banks and industry, and despite acknowledged differences, closer ties with the Soviet Union. Nationalization of banks, yes, there should be a national bank, and that's what the National Socialists did. But not the nationalization of all industry. I mean, that's taking away.
That's what happened in this country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's taken away private property and taken away the incentive to make wealth for oneself. And that is basic communism.
Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher sold every single asset that we possibly had, you know, on the cheap, so the Rothschilds could buy it up, North Sea oil being one. So this is, you know, not the right-wing firebrand, but obviously a left-wing communist subservient to the Rothschilds.
So I think you can see why they had to be dealt with, basically. Otto formed the Black Front, which was a group intended to split the NSDAP and depose Hitler as leader. And this group also functioned during his exile, because he was exiled from Germany, and in World War II as a secret opposition group. His brand of National Socialism is now known as Strasserism. So Otto is the one that survived. I think he ended up in Canada. And he's actually the source of a lot of the anti-Hitler, anti-National Socialist stuff that the conspiracy theorists use. The stuff
he ended up in Germany, didn't he?
Yeah, he ended up back in Germany as well. And he was responsible for saying that Hitler was a communist, Hitler was a Zionist, and he was the communist. Oh, wow. He was the communist.
Well, that's going to be an interesting debate, isn't it?
Yeah. And this idea at the time, this phrase, beefsteak Nazis, started being used in Germany. And what that meant was brown on the outside and red on the inside. Because at this time, the National Socialists were rising and the communists were losing. And loads of communists actually joined up with the National Socialists, which we've spoken about before. But not all of them.
It's funny to say, because I was doing some work today, obviously, with a possible debate in mind. And he called this Christopher, can't remember his second name.
Bjorkness.
But he called this, Nazi Bolts, half Bolsheviks, half Bolsheviks, half Nazis. Nazi Bolts. Have you ever heard anything as ridiculous?
Nazbol. Yeah, Nazbol. It's just a made up idea. But at this time, I mean, obviously it wasn't all of them. Some of these people that converted from communism to National Socialism, you know, it was a truthful conversion. And, you know, they realized, you know, what they were doing wrong. But some of these others, they just joined. Well, because of the success, the elevation of living standards.
Oh, yeah. But in this country and America and other places in the West, the youth, right, when they start to go to university and all this, and workers themselves start to realise, you know, that they've got to struggle for wages, Marxism is the only thing they can turn to, what they think they can only turn to. There's no alternative, because they fed this thing that, you know, it's for the workers against the bourgeois and, you know, the student revolutions and all this, change the world. But there's no alternative. But it's not an alternative anyway, because it's capitalism and communism, two sides of the same coin. But the way they look at it and the way they're educated on it, they think this is the only thing we've got, which is why a lot in Germany before National Socialism came along were communists.
Because they thought that was the only form of rebellion. I mean, is really the controlled opposition is capitalism and the controlled opposition is communism, you know, both of them. Yeah. Are controlled by the banks.
Always needs funding. And capitalism is there to fund it.
And also, when you think about it, I mean, when people first come across nationalism, I mean, we see this today, you know, you get new nationalists and they've still got a lot of the baggage of the way that they were thinking before. You know, they might think homosexuality is still okay, or they might think pornography is still okay, because they haven't fully worked out, you know, the cause of all these other problems that they're against. They haven't yet seen that it all originally grew from a seed into the rotten plant that we see today. They just see that
what I can't get me around.
Go on.
When I hear somebody on TV in a debate say, "I'm a Marxist, but I'm a Christian," now that's something I really can't get me around.
Yeah, there is nothing about handing everything away to foreigners. I mean, Christianity was about the people at the top, like the leaders having a communal wealth fund and working for themselves. But that was like the leaders at the top. That was the like the abbeys that we had and these monks that worked together, and they fed the poor. They weren't working to feed Africa or to feed Pakistan. They were
Africa's such passion then. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, they were working to feed, you know, they were working to feed the, people in their communities that needed it. And teaching them and educating them and teaching them to read and write and teaching them skills so that they could, you know, work for themselves. That's the problem with communism, is it's international and it says everything should be shared out among all these other peoples. And you have more in common with someone that does the same job as you rather than someone that's from the same family as you. That's the ludicrousness of it.
I'm pretty sure race is family. If I went up to Karl Marx and said, "Oh, Marx, I'm a Christian and I do believe in you. I'm pretty sure he'd give me a look."
Yeah, he would say he wanted to get rid of God. I mean, that's a part of communism as well, is the atheist side of it. So they had this faction. And they were part of the National Socialists, and they were also a large part of the Sturm Battalion that was doing the battles with the communists. You know, the brown shirts were defeating the communists. So a lot of the communists joined the NSDAP because they liked to fight, basically. And then they were on the side of, on this Sturm Battalion.
So to speak.
And the unfortunate.
Not yet government, but.
Yeah, this is 1933. Yeah. And Rome, was in charge of these stormtroopers. In actual fact, he had 2.5 million stormtroopers under his command by late 1933. And Rome...
He probably got sent to Brussels.
Yeah. Well, just let me stop there a minute. One of these things Strasser, one of these things that he put about were the reports from the homosexual doctor, and I've momentarily forgotten his name, from the Weimar period, Magnussen or something like that.
And
he had these reports on members of the National Socialists that had been sent to him for him to try and turn them straight or whatever. How he was going to do that when he was homosexual himself, I don't know. But he faked a lot of these reports and sent them to Strasser, who then published them, and that's where you get this idea that half the National Socialists were homosexual. There's a book called The Pink Swastika, and unfortunately, E. Michael Jones has used some of this, but that's where it came from. It came from Strasser, and Strasser got it from this pervert doctor. And Ernst Röhm probably was one of the accurate reports because he was a homosexual.
He was, yeah.
And again, this
guy used to make flashing quotes for flashers. First documentary.
That was probably the same guy.
Open your coat up and flash somebody. And the way they described it, the commentator thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, it was probably the same guy. I think it was Magnussen.
It is, yeah.
Something like that. But at the time, Röhm was in charge of all these stormtroopers. And he had a vision of purging the conservative faction. So there must have been quite a sizable left-wing faction here. And this reaction, as it was called in Germany, would entail even more nationalisation of industry, worker control of the means of production, so putting idiots in the place of managers, and the confiscation and redistribution of property and wealth of the upper classes. So theft, basically. Theft of anybody that was in the upper class, whether they were in the upper class because of usury or whether they were in the upper class because they'd worked very, very hard and they had good genes and came from a clever family, that didn't matter. Just confiscation and redistribution. And there's no difference between that and communism. And that was Rome's idea. So you had Rome and you had these Strassers there. Well, such ideological and political infighting within the NSDAP prompted Hitler to have his political rival Röhm and the other National Socialist radicals executed during the Night of the Long Knives in 1934.
Yeah.
So he had them executed. What do you know about this Night of the Long Knives, Dennis?
Well, funny enough, I get criticised for not going into it in the first documentary. And the reason I didn't go into it, like, was the same reason for all other parts what I left out, which I felt there'd been enough said on it, enough people had their own idea about it. And so I just wanted to go into areas which were less known, but obviously the documentary is stretching on and on and on, so I've got to be careful. So, well, somebody criticised me for it, and but like I said to him, the fact that I didn't do it doesn't mean I was hiding things, because from what I was aware of, the army itself, the German army, approached Hitler, you know, the top brass, and backed Hitler. They said that if you can get rid of these people, then we'll be 100% behind you. Because they were worried, because remember at that time, there were only 100,000 allowed by Versailles. And like I said, Rome had more. So, you know, it's a problem what needed to be sorted. And in all great power struggles and great leaders, you need that ruthless streak. And if Hitler didn't show it, he would have copped it himself one day. And so, you know, like I said, I didn't go into it for any other reason than, you know, it had been covered by other people and covered a lot. But if I had gone into it, I'm pretty sure, you know, Hitler would have still come out, you know, on top, because it needed to be sorted.
Well, I mean, these guys were a threat. They were causing a lot of trouble. A lot of thugs that basically wanted to steal everything from the rich and take over the country. I mean, it's the same ideology as the Bolsheviks, which was just, you know, let's just steal everything from the rich and we'll run the country. I mean, that's what it means.
Well, Rob looks a thug anyway, isn't it? I can hardly see him being a diplomat.
He's queer, wasn't he?
Wrong. Well, he was queer. But I mean, like, so he looked a thug.
This idea of the workers taking control of the means of production, I mean, that's just guaranteed to fail. I mean, these are really stupid ideas. This Night of the Long Knives, that actually gets its name from an event that happened in probably about 500 AD when the Saxons were coming over to the Britons. And this is before the Saxons were Christian. And there was a love day was set up, and the top brass of the Saxons were supposed to go and meet the top brass of the Britons, and without any weapons. And this was, you know, this was a tradition. This was a chivalry tradition that was had by the civilized white nations at the time. And they would have an area that was cordoned off, and they would go into this area, and it was called a love day, and they would eat and they would drink and they would make peace, basically, without any weapons. And the Britons went there, and they sent all their princes there, and the Saxons went there, and the Saxons all had hidden knives in their boots. And on the word, they all pulled these knives out and slaughtered all the British princes. A really horrible thing to do. But, you know, this is why you would say, well, the Saxons were pretty barbaric before they became Christian. And that's what this was actually named for, was that incident. And there was bad feeling against the Welsh and against the Saxons. There's probably bad feeling against them still to this day because of that. Yeah. I mean, it's like slaughtering someone under the white flag. So maybe it's not such a good name to call this the Night of the Long Knives. And I don't know what the Saxon side of it is. You know, maybe the Saxons or the Germans have got a story of their own from their past, where they tell what went on there from the other side of it. If they have, I'd like to read it or learn about it. Anyway.
I mean, anyway, it was an easy power grab, if nothing else.
Yeah, that was. But many of those killed in the Purge were leaders of the SA, the best known being Röhm himself, the SA's chief of staff and one of Hitler's longtime supporters and allies. Leading members of the leftist-leaning Strasserite faction of the National Socialist Party, including its figurehead, Gregor Strasser, were also killed. And don't forget, Otto Strasser had actually left, he'd been expelled from the National Socialists, back in 1930, and Rome as well. I mean, they also said that he was homosexual. I mean, that's why he was executed. That was the reason why he was executed. So I suspect they actually had reasons for why these people were executed that they gave afterwards. You know, this is the reason why this guy was killed, because he was plotting sedition. Because don't forget, these guys were plotting on having a revolution, replacing Hitler, taking all the property, redistributing it. So they would have justified all of this afterwards. It wasn't just a question of like, well, right, well, let's just get rid of all our opposition. I mean, these guys were actually planning on having a violent and bloody revolution. So they needed to take out...
That was probably the proper reason, weren't it? I mean, this saying they killed them because they were homosexual gives people the opportunity to say that the Nazis persecuted homosexuals, which they didn't persecute homosexuals any different than any other country at that time. It was taboo in practically every country I can think of.
Yeah, it's always been illegal right up until the last couple of decades, really. Well, Otto, following his expulsion, he set up his own party, which was called the Black Front, composed of like-minded former NSDAP members, in an attempt to split the NSDAP. But his party proved unable to counter Hitler's rise to power in 1933, and Strasser spent the years of the National Socialist era in exile. The National Socialist left itself was annihilated during the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, in which his brother was killed, leaving Hitler as the undisputed party leader and able to pacify both the industrialists and the military into accepting his new National Socialist vision. In addition to the Black Front, Strasser at this time headed the Free German Movement outside Germany, which sought to enlist the aid of Germans throughout the world in bringing about the downfall of Hitler and his vision of National Socialism. So he was a traitor, really.
I was going to say he was a traitor.
Yeah, the Free German Movement on the outside. Yeah. I mean, this is a sort of thing like the French Resistance, isn't it? You're probably getting Allied funding.
Probably financed with Jews.
During his exile, he wrote articles on National Socialist Germany and its leadership for a number of British, American, and Canadian newspapers, including The New Statesman and a series for the Montreal Gazette, which was ghostwritten by then-Gazette reporter and later politician Donald C. MacDonald. So this is where, you know, the conspiracy theorists and the partial truth movement, this is where they're getting the info. And some of it, you know, it was ghost written by a reporter claiming to be this Otto. And then it's repeated as, oh, this is what really happened. This is what the National Socialists were really like. And it's all propaganda, and some of it not even written by the person it was supposed to have been written by. Otto Strasser was permitted to return to West Germany in 1955 after years of being denied entry by the West German government due to a ruling of the Federal Administrative Court. He regained his citizenship and settled in Munich. Now, don't forget, this is somebody that was in the National Socialists in the early years, and he's allowed to return in 1955. And no problems. So he's obviously, you know, working for the enemy, wasn't he?
Yeah,
they've tried to be rewarded. Otherwise, they'd have been after.
They've tried to infiltrate the guy working for the Rothschilds.
And look what else he did. Otto Strasser claimed he was a dissenting Nazi regarding racial policies. So he's trying to say, "Oh no, I wasn't racist." Well, they wouldn't have had him in the party if he wasn't a racial loyalist. During his later life, he claimed to have actively opposed such racial policies within the National Socialist movement. For example, by claiming to have organized the removal of Julius Streicher from the German Volkisch Freedom Party. So he's just basically a traitor. I don't understand why, you know, some people today say, oh, we're Strasserites and we follow Strasserism. I was very surprised to find that part of the National Front were involved in supporting this guy. And as I say, I've heard of others saying that they follow these Strasser ideas. Mm. And he was really an anti-capitalist more than anything else. But, you know, anti-capitalism, you need to be anti-communism as well. But both of them, as we say, are controlled opposition. And you've got to be racial. Yeah. Everything's got to be based on race. So, that's what happened with the Strassers, and what Strasserism is. I hope that answers Mr. Simple's question. And we've got one final topic to talk about, Dennis. You've been looking into something called the Dawes Plan, haven't you? Do you want to tell us what that is?
Well, yeah, if I can get my head around it. Yeah, I mean, it started around 1920 when Hitler went to prison, believe it or not, and they felt the SDP and the Centre Party felt that they could now take an opportunity now to get rid of the National Socialists for good, because obviously they're all locked up. And so when he came out, he had to start from scratch. In fact, even worse, at one point he was banned from actually speaking for 2 years. And still, as progress was made, you know, the National Socialists started to increase, to a point where by the time they got to the election, which was 1933, there was around about a million National Socialists what he managed to convince. But that's at 33. But going back now to this this plan, this was, I think it was Ludenberg who said this is going to work, especially if we pay the Versailles Treaty, what they're demanding there, pay all them off. Germany will be better for it. But Hitler was saying complete opposite. You know, he was saying you're never going to pay them debts off because of the usury. And rather than build the country up financially, it will destroy Germany, because what they were saying, you know, the ones in for it were, they can help the farmers, and by helping the farmers, you know, more food will be around and all this. But Hitler was adamant what they were planning was going to be the complete opposite.
So it was a huge loan. It was a huge loan that they were offering, was it?
Yeah, it's just another money scam for the bankers. And this Dawes Plan, either the Young Plan turned into the Dawes Plan, which was an extension, or vice versa. But certainly by 1931, you know, what Hitler had been saying all along was coming, obviously, to fruition. You could see the demise. And even like in the rumors, I mean, they used to say the SDP and Centre Party, they used to say like that, you know, we won't have people going into the Ruhr running, you know, the French running and the Belgian running places. The Ruhr will be safe. And like Hitler said, you know, it ain't going to be safe. And it weren't safe because they did go in. So everything Hitler was saying and predicting came true, which no doubt helped with the fact that his numbers were swelling for time for the election. But it's something I've never heard of before. It's what it would have done, because this is what I believe, that the Versailles Treaty we've talked about before, where they've dissected Germany up and they put chunks into other countries or made into new countries like Czechoslovakia. Poland would take a chunk, and bits of Germany would be run by France for 15 years. All this was designed to actually break Germany, because as we know, Germany didn't start that war anyway, but they were found the culprits, had to pay all the reparations and were punished. So that was one way of dissecting Germany to a slow death. Now, this was another way, because what it would have done, as Hitler showed what it was doing, it would have destroyed the farmers. It would have destroyed, unemployment went up. It would have drawn millions out of Germany into places like France, and they again would be lost in time and swallowed up by these other countries, while Germany just went into a slow death. And that really was the plan right from the word go, because even back in, first in 1933, when the Jews declared war on Germany, there was a boot, you know, Germany must perish, which was well received by the American press. It wasn't classed as hate speech, and it asked for the destruction of Germany. And that is exactly what they're intending to do, like we found out with the bankers, who were sending money not only to the Weimar Republic for the last 2 years, but they were sending money to Hitler, and Hitler weren't paying nothing back, and the Weimar couldn't pay anything back. And yet they were still sending money. As you know, and everybody else listening knows, when you're in debt, that day does come when the bank, there's a knock on the door and we want our money. And if you haven't got the money then everything goes, house, furniture, the lot. And that was the plan, I'm pretty sure, for Germany.
Well, I was just going to ask, do you think that ties in with that other quote that we discussed a while back, where he was saying that this money that you've been sending to Hitler, it hasn't been servicing the debt, he's been spending it on anti-Semitic propaganda and building up the National Socialists. Yeah, because that would have been it. They offered to lend all this money, expecting it just to be paid back on the interest on this on the debt, which is this is the way that the banks always operate. It's even the benefits office works in this way now. When you don't have any money and you're just about to go on benefits, they don't say, "Well, we'll give you your benefits now." They say, "Well, you're not going to get your benefits for 12 weeks, but we'll give you a loan." And then, of course, when you get your benefits, you know, they're calculated to be the absolute bare minimum that you need to live on. There's no extra bit there accounted for so that you can pay back loans. So right away, you're starting with this debt that you've got to pay back that you can't actually pay back. And you've got interest on that as well, which is effectively what was happening here. They couldn't afford to start up new businesses. What they needed was an increase of wealth to help them start up new businesses. And they weren't going to get that. They were just going to get enough money to pay the interest on the debt. And then on top of that little bit of money to pay the interest, they were going to be expected to pay more interest on top. This is why they had to totally reform the banking system and start from scratch and say, well, we'll create our own promissory notes and we'll give them out to stimulate building the autobahns and reinvigorating industry. And when these notes come back, we'll zero them. And we'll cut out the middleman when we do deals with other countries again, which saved them loads of money. But that was the only way to do it.
The question you have to ask, I'm not quite up to speed on how many trillion America owes, but I'm pretty sure that debt's never going to get paid off. And it's a similar thing. It's only going to eventually come to a crash. And the bankers never suffer, as we know. It'll be us who suffer.
Yeah, they make actual wealth out of it, don't they? They don't actually create any wealth. They just put numbers on the ledger sheet. And then when people can't actually pay those numbers back, then they move in and say, and now we'll take all that wealth that you have created, all those properties, all those factories, everything that you own. And in the first place, the bank, the banking system used to be based on gold. So at least they could say, well, 10% of everything we've loaned out, we do actually hold in gold reserves, but they don't even have that anymore. It's not even based upon that because there is so much debt. They can't possibly call all of it in. I mean, I did a podcast on this yesterday with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson, which sort of touched on this. And this is why in the Bible, they had a fail-safe built in, which was every 40 years or every 50 years, all the debts go back to zero and all the property goes back to who it was originally. So all the land basically goes back to who it was originally.
So it stops this robbery, doesn't it?
Yeah, it stops it. And everything is zeroed and it's called a Jubilee year. And I think Alfred the Great had that in his law code in England. That was something that the early Christians, that's what they instituted. They had a Jubilee year. They had no usury in the first place. Yeah. But this made certain that, people, what happened in Germany where they sold off the family farms, that could never happen because every 50 years it would go back to the original owners and let alone selling it abroad to foreigners. I mean, that's just unheard of.
And yet today, foreigners would own them.
Yeah, well, everything's owned by foreigners today. It's absolutely crazy system that we've fallen for that needs fixing. But if we'd only just stuck with the Christian system in the first place, we wouldn't be in that mess today. Anyway, that brings us to the end of the podcast. Dennis, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great summer weekend ahead of you. Thank you.
tuned into